Znanost na cesti.
Poljudnoznanstvena predavanja na javnih mestih po Sloveniji.
Za radovedne, vedoželjne, natančne, bistre in odklopljene, zamaknjene in budne, gike in tiste, ki to absolutno nočete biti, mlade in stare, pridružite se nam na cesti, na Znanosti na cesti.
Dober večer vsem skupaj. Lepo pozdravljeni na 8 skeptikih v pubu. Moje ime je Anja in sem izobraževalna raziskovalka na CERN-u v Švici in zelo sem vesela, da se vas je tok danes oglasilo na temnem dogodku. Sem tako na hitro o skeptikih. Dogodki skeptiki v pubu potekajo vse povsod po svetu, v Sloveniji pa v organizaciji Znanosti na cesti in Univerze v Ljubljani je tole že 8 dogodek. In v resnici je to že kar drugi dogodek na temo fizike delcev, očitno smo kar mečkem popularni. No, v resnici ta danes poteka na pobudo mednarodne mreže za popularizacijo fizike delcev. Zato bomo danes tudi mečkem posebni, malo bomo govorili po angleško, malo bomo govorili po slovensko, tako da se že vnaprej upravičujem, če mi kaka beseda v slovenščini vsem uide. Beseda v angleščini bo kvečemu višla. Torej, tokratna tema je fizika osnovnih delcev, ampak danes gledamo ne v tisto fiziko osnovnih delcev, ki jo že poznamo, ampak fiziko osnovnih delcev v neki prihodnosti, bližnji, daljni, bomo videli. Torej, naši današnji gosti nam bodo poskušali povedati, kaj še sploh lahko odkrijemo in kakšna je verjetnost, da bomo kaj novega odkrili prav s temi nekimi novimi pospeševalniki, novimi detektori za fiziko delcev. Pa dajmo kar predstaviti današnje goste. En izmed njih je moj šef, tako da prosim, ne se smejati, ker rečem njegovo ime, ker potem bom mogoče zgubila službo, še preden jo orang začnem. Torej, ta prvi je Arnaud Marsoje, vodja skupine za izobraževanje in komunikacijo znanosti v CERN-u. Druga je doktorica Kari Cesaroti, teoretična fizičarka na področju fizike visokih energij. In tretja je doktorica Kate Shaw, izredna profesorica fizike na Univerzi Sussex in Mednarodnem centru za teoretično fiziko. Torej, vsak izmed njih nam bo pokazal oziroma predstavil neko novo idejo. Nek drugačen pospeševalnik, nek drugačen detektor, neke drugačne delce. Tako da, brez skrbi ne bomo v resnici ostali samo pri teoriji fizike delcev. Torej, delam prvič, pa mi je malo težko že strani obračati. Torej, kdo izmed vas bi znal kaj povedati o fiziki delcev? Jaz se vidim, da sem vprašala po slovensko, ker oni bi zihar znali kaj. Tako da bomo počas pol prešaljte na angliško, ampak dajmo raj kar začeti z našim prvim govorcem. Prvi govorec, kot sem rekla, je Arnaud Marsoje. In je vodja skupine za izobraževanje in komunikacijo znanosti v CERN-u. V dolgoletni karieri na področju znanstvene komunikacije in odnosov z mediji je pomagal globalnemu občinstvu približati vrhunske raziskave fizike delcev v CERN-u, vse od začetka delovanja velikega hadronskega trkalnika, ki ga mogoče poznate pod bolj angleškim imenom LHC, in odkritja Higgsovega bozona, pa vse sedaj do prihodnosti pospeševalnikov delcev. V preteklosti je delal tudi za francoski CNRS, ter kot višji strokovnjak za komunikacijo pri Evropski vesoljski agenciji ESA, kjer je med drugim sodeloval pri komunikaciji ob izstrelitvi teleskopa James Webb. Zdaj pa, da bo on tudi kaj razumel, pa da lahko še njega kaj vprašam, bom pa res prešaltala na angliščino. So, Arnaud, could you please join me?
I'm telling you, I will speak in English.
Okay, so just a quick question. Your biography goes from the very smallest particles at CERN to the universe. So you've probably met a bunch of different physicists. Are there any differences between those who are looking at particles and those who are looking at huge stuff in the universe?
No, a physicist is a physicist. Basically, I think they look into maybe different questions, but the goal is the same. And the approach to things is quite similar. So if you talk to them, you will not understand what they say. They tell you, and they will go into details that you will be lost immediately.
But now maybe a bit more challenging question. Which one do you prefer to communicate, the physics, the particle physics, or the astrophysics?
Well, I didn't do a lot of astrophysics, but it's clear, I mean, any communicator will tell that, I mean, of course, astrophysics is easier because you have the nice images, which you don't have with particle physics. And actually, astrophysicists sometimes say that particle physics, they store the images and the stories that is from them.
Okay, that's a good answer, I think. Well, I will not keep you at the astrophysics for too long. Let's go into the future of particle physics. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, there is a bit of astrophysics still in there because we cannot disconnect things fully. So I think I did not understand anything, but I think I was introduced, so I will not go into the details about me. So yeah, I work at CERN, which is the biggest lab for particle physics in the world. And yeah, I wanted to just start with a map just to represent what it is. So for those who've been in Geneva, maybe you recognize, you have here the Lake Geneva. And basically, CERN is around there, but it's also around there and around everywhere, because here the ring is the Large Hadron Collider, the biggest accelerator in the world. And this is from a machine we use every day to collide particles and try to understand how matter works and how the universe was born. Understanding particle physics and astrophysics is a bit the same thing. We'll touch a bit on that, but just a bit. And what is important is also about CERN, because sometimes we hear that it's a Swiss lab. It's not a Swiss lab. CERN is really an international organization. We have 25 member states, and actually we have 110 nationalities working at CERN. So it's really, really a global endeavor with thousands of physicists coming there to work together from any nation. And the role of CERN into that is really to build the particle accelerator, to run them, maintain them, so for the benefit of a wide scientific community. I mean, now we say about 17,000 people worldwide contribute to some experiments. So the LHC, which is our quantum machine, it's good to start from where we are. It's a 27 kilometer ring, the ring that you saw on the map just before. Superconductive magnets, very cold, very, very cold, and billions of collisions every second. It's a crazy machine, basically. And to go with the particle accelerator is there to accelerate particles and bring them together and to collide them at the center of big detectors. So here is one of the big detectors at CERN, CMS, which is one of the experiments that helped discover the Higgs boson. And you see a bit the scale of it. So the ring is 27 kilometers. And each of the big experiments is the size of, 20 stages buildings or something like that. So it's really, really impressive. Okay, so this is where we talk about a bit about particle physics and astrophysics. We'll go a bit again. Because sometimes it's difficult to make understand why we try to collide particles. So if you think about things, telescopes, they are here to look into the sky. And the farther you can go, the closer you go to the origin of the universe. Just to make this understand, because sometimes it's so difficult. So the moon is very close. The light coming from the moon takes 1 second to come to the Earth. The sun is a bit further. It's 8 minutes for the light to come. So when we look at galaxies, which are very, very far, actually, it's like looking into the past. So the older things we can look is around there. So if you buy a big telescope, as big as you want, you can go up to there. But then the universe becomes dark. You cannot see anymore. So between the beginning of the universe and 300,000 years, something like that, we can't see with telescopes. And we can see because actually the particles, I mean, the light could not go through the medium. The particles were just were blocking the light to go out. So it's a bit why we do particle collisions, because when we do particle collisions, we recreate a bit what was existing at the beginning of the universe. So we are able to recreate particles that don't exist every day around us, but they were existing there. So in a way, when we create these particles and we can look at them and we can study them, it's like having a telescope looking into that part about the processes that are happening there. And why do we do that? Because actually, the more we look into the universe and the more we look into the particles, the more we understand that there are things we don't understand. And I mean, there are many different big questions, but I will just mention a few of them. And one probably of the biggest one, which is not so old, is the fact that if we look at the universe, we understand today that we are able to describe only 5% of it. 95% of the universe, we don't know what it is, and we don't know how it works. There's something that we call dark matter. We know it's there because we can see it from telescopes, especially with some phenomena that are based on gravity that tell that there is matter there, but we can't see it, but we know it's there. There is something that we call dark energy that is responsible for the expansion of the universe, which accelerates, and we don't understand why. And when we count everything that we can see, all the matter, all the phenomena, but we see that 95% of the universe, we don't know what it is. So one of the possibilities is that there is some kind of matter that we've never seen before, that we could create through our collisions. And this is one of the things that you try to do with the LHC. Another question, which is a lot related to the universe, is that we think that at the beginning of the universe, as much matter and antimatter were created. Antimatter is very similar to matter, but with opposite charge. But when we look into the universe, we see only matter, and we don't understand why. When we do collisions in the particle accelerator, it's like creating little big bangs. We create as much matter and antimatter. But when we look at the universe, so 14 billion years after the Big Bang, we don't know where the antimatter left. And okay, there are also questions about gravity, but I will pass that one. It's big questions. That's not just small questions and big questions. Only 5% of the universe, we know what it is. So we do collisions. So this is just to show what a collision looks like. So as you've seen CMS just before, this is a collision from ATLAS this time. The other big detector at CERN, and so at the center of the detector, which is like a big 3D camera, we have the collisions, and then the detector is recording all the tracks of all the particles. And with computers, we're able to redraw what happened in the collision, and this is where we can really study the different behaviors of the particles between themselves. And this is how we really study the processes that are happening at very small scales. So, what do you know about particles? Do you know some names of particles you could mention? So, you know that we have matter, atoms are probably known to all of you. Then proton, quarks. Do you know other particles? Anybody? Huh? Leptons, okay. Bosons, wow, okay. More common ones, some we use every day. Electrons, yeah, sure. So this is the kind of particles we are looking at. We love to put them in a big table, and then this is all the yeah, almost all the particles all the families of particles. So yes, we have here what I would call ordinary matter, and the electron is probably the most common thing. I mean, we use it in electricity, electronics, and so on. So that's one. But then we have a whole other families of particles. I will not give the details because we don't have time. I have 10 minutes. I'm surely already beyond time. This is where I wanted to go. We have very strange particles here. So photons are quite known. What are they used for? Photons. Light. Yeah, photons are light. Bosons, they were mentioned. Gluons. Gluons are interesting ones. And gravitons. We don't know if they exist, but they could. Okay. So these particles are responsible for the forces. And then on top of that, we have, I mean, what you all probably heard about in 2012, the discovery of the Higgs boson, which is a bit special. So it's not on one of the columns or one of the lines. It's a bit on the side. Very, very special particle. We were looking for it for almost 50 years. And that was kind of a big deal. So why is it so special? One of the things why what? Ah, I'm too close. I have to move. Okay. The Higgs, especially. I mean, before the Higgs, we could not say why particles have a mass. So from the theory, which we call the standard model of particle physics, all the particles should have the same mass. But this is not what we observe. We have light particles, we have heavier particles. So we had to create something. I mean, it was a crazy idea, a field, the Higgs field, which is responsible for how the particles get their mass. So you have to imagine that you have plenty of Higgs particles everywhere. And when a particle goes through this medium, then if it becomes heavy or it becomes light, it's a bit the way it works. And why is the Higgs so important for us today? Well, two things. First, it's the latest particle we found. So we don't know it so much. And the image we have is a bit blurry still. So we know it's there. It's clear. We have catched it. But of course, this is a new one. So maybe we would like to study it in more detail to see if there are some things that are a bit interesting to see into the properties of the Higgs. And one thing especially which is interesting is the Higgs, as is the new particle we discovered, might be something that could help us to solve maybe some of the mysteries I mentioned. Maybe dark matter, maybe antimatter. We don't know, but the fact that it's new is a good idea to explore. So some of the questions about the Higgs. So where does the Higgs come from? Is it an elementary particle or is it composed of other things inside? Well, that's a good question. I mean, maybe we can still go down in the scales. Is it unique or have several Higgs? That's a question that physicists would like to answer. And does it interact to other particles? And for instance, could it be that through interactions of the Higgs with something we've never seen before, we could discover something like dark matter particles? That's one of the questions. So it brings me to the need to study the Higgs in more details. So to study the Higgs in more details, if you want to study something in more detail, you need a bigger tool somehow. That's a bit the idea. So the plan now would be maybe to build a new collider, which would be three times bigger than the current one. So 27 kilometers is already big, but we would like to go even further. So it would be 200 meters underground, and the cost is evaluated to 15 billion Swiss francs. It would help us to really study the properties of the Higgs in detail, maybe to search for new particles, as I mentioned. Maybe antimatter could have a new insights on what happened to antimatter. And of course, I mean, as long as you have a new tool which is much more precise and much bigger, you can explore. Actually, it's really a tool to explore and see if you can discover new phenomena. There are so big questions that there must be something else we don't know that we could discover. To come back to astrophysics and to explain a bit what it means going having more precision, I took this time a picture of the Hubble Space Telescope, which is very famous. It's called the Deep Field. All the little points you see on the photo are galaxies. So you zoom into the universe, and you discover that if you look really far away in the universe, you have galaxies everywhere. So that was a shock when astrophysicists took this picture. But now, when you move from the Hubble telescope to the James Webb telescope, this is the same field of the sky. With James Webb, you see that the galaxies that were little points, suddenly you can see more details. So this is a bit what we would like to do with our new collider. We would like to go from a blurry image of the Higgs to a clear picture of the Higgs. So that's it. And of course, just to conclude, because I think I'm over time. So this is what we say it would be. Really, this collider is a machine for a new generation of people. I mean, so it's for the young people to grow and become scientists. It's for engineers, because to build something like that, it's really, really challenging. It's for also developing new technologies that might be useful for society. So when we do accelerators, I mean, we create new things. The web was invented at CERN, not because we wanted to invent the web, because we needed a tool to communicate. A lot of the technologies that exist in hospitals, should it be medical imagery or some accelerators to treat cancers, or super powerful magnets for MRIs, come from particle physics as well. So of course, pushing the boundaries of science also is pushing the boundaries of technology, and will help also to develop new things. So I think I have to finish. So this is Higgs saying goodbye, but I think we have a conversation after that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. The next thing is I'm going to ask them if they have any questions. So yeah, I would like you to ask Steve. Imamo kako vprašanje, lahko v slovenščini, lahko v angleščini, oni bodo razumeli samo v angleščini, sam se znamo prevesti.
When is the due date for the completion of the next accelerator?
The timeline, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not an approved project yet. We hope to have the approval for the project in 2028. And if we get the green light to go for it, it means we would start digging the tunnel in 33, and we would start the machines in 45, something like that, at the earliest, huh? Because so it's a 20, 30 years project. Yeah.
Okay. Jim?
Okay, so as far as I understand, the LHC was supposed to observe Higgs and its successes, and then FCC will be for precision. But then we also missing the observation of graviton. So what kind of machine should I think of in order to detect the graviton?
Oh, I think it's a question for you. I'm not a physicist, so what is the? I'm not sure we know the machine we would need to discover the graviton. Do you have an idea? Gravitons? How we
attach that? That's not a collider physics problem. I'm so sorry. No, gravitons. The way that we would discover gravitons is really not through collider experiments. It's going to be through things observed on much bigger scales where we can see smaller phenomena. So it's a question much more for astronomy, astrophysics, than something we can do. The energy scales are just way too high for what we can be able to achieve by like 10 to the 20 order, like 20 orders of magnitude too high. So this is 3 orders of magnitude. We're off by another 17.
It's a bit why when I mentioned gravitons, I kept it on the side.
Thank you.
Okay, then thank you so much for this. Zdaj si bomo vzeli ene, dve, tri minutke, da si lahko še kdo vzame kaj za pit, pa malo pauze, potem pa nadaljujemo z našo naslednjo govorko. Hvala.
We have 2 to 3 minutes of a break.
Yeah, to those who are speaking English, we have 2 to 3 minutes of a break. Ok, kot smo videli v prvem delu, nas lahko prihodnost kar precej zanima in kar precej stvari lahko opazimo že na modernih idejah. Veliki pospeševalniki, velike številke, velike sanje. No, z naslednjo govorko bodo pa te sanje postale še mečkem bolj sanjave. Saj tokrat pa ne bomo več govorili o nečem, kjer imamo že plane, pa kjer imamo že denar, zamišljen vsaj, pa kjer dejansko že komuniciramo, kdaj se bo kaj zgradilo. Zdaj naša naslednja govorka, Carrie Casarotti, bo govorila pa o mionskih pospeševalnikih. Pa zdaj čisto hitro še o njej. Torej, doktorica Carrie Casarotti je čez dan teoretična fizičarka na področju fizike visokih energij, v prostem času pa ilustratorka, slikarka. Njeno raziskovalno delo je usmerjeno v razvoj teorij in modelov novih delcev ter sil, ki bi jih lahko zaznali v trkalnikih delcev. Prihaja iz ZDA, doktorirala je na Univerzi Harvard, nato pa je nadaljevala podoktorsko raziskovalno delo na MIT. Lani se je pridružila teoretični skupini v CERNu, poleg svojega teoretičnega dela je pa močna zagovornica naslednje generacije trkalnikov delcev, predvsem mionskih trkalnikov. Ko se ne ukvarja s fiziko ali pa ustvarja, pa rada vozi svoje zložljivo kolo, vrtnari na balkonu ali eksperimentira s 3D tiskalnikom. So, Carrie, you mentioned that you like using a 3D printer. Do you think we could 3D print a particle accelerator?
It's theoretically possible when you stretch. So I'm a theorist, so everything's theoretically possible. If you stretch the definition of 3D printing, you know, if you, one day maybe we'll be able to 3D print magnets, but for now I don't think plastic is very superconducting.
Ah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. But you also, you went back to the theoretical, to being a theoretical physicist. And I have to ask this. You're a theoretical physicist proposing experiments. How does that even work? Like, aren't you supposed to be in a different world?
Fair. So that's an excellent point. And in particle physics, often we do think of this as two very separate ideas. But really, who better to inform what we should go look for except for the people that calculate what there is to look for, right? So experiment world, oops, that's gone. In the experiment world, they do a great job understanding what the limits are and how we can build and how we can actualize these experiments. There's so much chaos happening around me. And the theorists, our job is to understand what's possible on the physics side. So we give the vision, the experimentalists pull it through, and we all work together to understand what physics we can do with it.
Okay, so collaboration all the way.
Always.
Okay, good. Well, I will not keep you talking to me. Let's hear about muon colliders. And I know if you want to move back, you can.
All right. So thank you to my lovely colleague for giving such a nice introduction about the LHC and collider physics in general. So I want to talk about one of the wackier ideas we have. Arnaud finished his talk with a nice introduction of a future project called the Future Circular Collider. Hopefully one day it'll be the current Circular Collider. But let me tell you about another idea we have that's completely new from what we've done so far, which is the Muon Collider. So of course, the question that you should all have when someone proposes an experiment is, what do we want to do with this, right? And the goal that we have is we want to go where we haven't gone before. We want to do something completely new in the realm of particle physics, and that is both on the technological side and the reach of the high energy that we hope to achieve. So like you can think about in the past talk, going further back in the universe with these high energies, right? So why should this be our goal? Well, in particle physics, the goal that we want to have is we want to understand the most fundamental building blocks of the universe. And we call the things that we found and put together and understand the forces of the standard model, which is our catalog of known particles and forces. So the way that we've discovered this is basically a lot through collider physics. And what we've seen is that as we, well, this is not doing anything. All right, let me just point. So as we've gone through time, we've built higher and higher energy machines. And as we build these machines, as we always learn something new about the universe. Okay, so as we've built these machines, we've been able to discover this third generation, so things that are much heavier than the particles that we experience in our daily life. We've seen what we call the gauge bosons, the particles that mediate the forces that hold atoms together and things like that. And recently at the LHC, we've even discovered the Higgs boson, which we suspect is the particle that gives all the other particles mass. And this has always been achieved through increasing the collider energy. Okay. So what's the problem that we have with particle physics today? The problem is that even though we have a wonderful standard model that's extremely consistent with the things we've seen, it can't explain everything that we've seen in the universe. So at best, our fundamental theory of nature is inconsistent or is unsatisfying. And at worst, it's just strictly inconsistent. Right? And to give you a sense of what some of these problems are, we can think about them as sort of abstract to concrete. So very abstractly, if this is our standard model, why? Why does it have this shape? Why does it have this categories? What gives it this structure? All right, we can think about more empirical things. Maybe you've heard of neutrino masses. This was a Nobel Prize a few years ago. We don't have a theoretical reason why neutrinos should have mass. And as you also just heard about, what is dark matter? There's all this stuff in the universe we don't understand. All of these are big questions that really signal that there's something fundamental we don't yet understand. Right. And so if we think about how to do science, you know, a lot of times we want to imagine just someone in a lab coat going to a microscope and just looking at a slide. And maybe that's what we should do in particle physics too. Maybe we should just go to those high energies where we haven't yet been able to explore and just see what's out there. Because maybe that's all we need to do to understand the next motivation for the theories we should build. So we just heard about these nice machines. We talked about colliding protons at the LHC. We talked about the possibility of higher energy electrons at future colliders. Why should we collide muons? And the reason is that muons are really the best of both worlds. Muons provide insight that we would get both from electrons and protons. So we get the precision of electrons, that resolution of the image, and we get the energy of protons, meaning we get that further back picture in the history of our universe. So why should this be true, right? So what we've done so far is we accelerate matter and antimatter. So antimatter and dark matter are very different things. Dark matter is something that we know exists but don't know the particle content. Antimatter is something we can produce in the lab. So we have very good control over antimatter, and it's just the same as regular matter, but with the opposite charge. So what we do at the LHC is we collide protons and protons. Before, we've collided protons and antiprotons. And before that, we've even collided electrons and anti-electrons, right? So with the electrons, these are very clean, nice particles. They're just the particle itself. They only carry their energy and their mass. And there's nothing else going on except the one electron. At higher energies, that becomes less true. But ask me about that after a second spritz. Okay. So what's nice about this is that you know what comes in, so you can understand very well what comes out. And at collisions, when you have billions of particles coming out of your collisions and detector all the time, having a clean starting space is very useful. The problem with electrons is that they can't go much faster than what we've been able to accelerate them before, because as you accelerate them more, they lose more energy, right? So this is called synchrotron radiation. But basically, as an electron moves through a curved path, because all of our colliders are circular, is it loses some momentum to photons, is that it takes away some energy. So there is just a theoretical limit about how much energy we can put into these kind of machines. For protons, you can see a proton is a bag of stuff. And that stuff, if you want to get technical, is called partons or gluons and other quarks. But basically, there's three main particles that you're colliding. So any one collision is only going to have a fraction of the total energy, as only two of these particles are going to collide with each other. But they suffer this a lot less because they're more massive. So they can be accelerated to much higher energies, and that's what we do at the LHC. With muons, we kind of get the best of both things. So muons are the heavy cousin of electrons. They're basically the same in every capacity, except they have more mass, and that unleashes more physics. Right? And so if we were to accelerate them and collide them, then we would have the clean environment of a fundamental particle, but at the same time, the high energy environment that we do with protons. And so this two-for-one deal is really why this acceleration technology would be really exciting. Right? So this is a plot that a lot of physicists would show that probably doesn't mean much to lay people. But let me just say that when you have low energy particle physics, what you're trying to do is you're trying to understand very small differences between what you expect and what you measure. That's precision. When you go to very high energies, you're just exploring uncharted territory, and you can see something completely unexpected over what you might have calculated there to be. So this is the difference between these two paradigms, is measuring small differences and seeing unexplored things. Okay, and doing both of these with one machine would be an amazing way to search for new physics in general. Especially because the truth is, we don't really know what should be out there. If we think about how this machine would compare to the other machine that Arno just brought up, this is going to be a much smaller machine, and it has to be by design. So what's tricky about it is that muons don't live forever, right? All of the particles that make up our daily world, they do live for quite a long time, because if not, we ourselves could not exist. We would decay away into smaller, lighter things. Right, so a muon has to be small for this technology to work. So these machines that we project them to be, we'd have to dig a very big hole. 91 kilometers is the current expectation to be able to achieve this program. But for muons, it would have to be much, much smaller. So if we're concerned about our environmental impact, how much we disrupt the community, having a smaller machine is always a better thing, right? And additionally, again, these are numbers that maybe mean more to physicists. But the point is that these are kind of comparable numbers. So the high energy you can achieve with sort of the future stages of this machine that we're thinking about at CERN could be comparable, and the precision would be comparable with the electrons too. So it's again kind of these two things in a very small, nice package, right? There's some talks about doing it at CERN if it were to be in Europe. There's also some talks about doing it in the US. Who knows what goes on over there, quite frankly. But it's nice that there's a couple laboratories in the world that are interested in supporting this goal. All right, so coming back to this sort of general purpose, what do we want to learn with this machine? And really the question that we're trying to ask is the standard model correct? And if not, where does it go wrong? I'm getting a little shifted in my slides. Let me know. Perfect. Okay. So basically the two things that we're trying to ask basically is, does this look like what we expect? And how do we look for things that we don't expect? And so the two most relevant physics scenarios that we want to understand is, does this look like standard model? And what other things could it be? So the things that we know that we can study, the things that we know that we can learn at the muon collider, are usually relating to the Higgs boson. So ideally, we could be producing 10 million Higgs bosons, and that would be a lot to study and, again, get that precision picture with this muon collider. And otherwise, we want to think about what else could be out there with exploration. So this famous equation E equals mc squared is really the crux of it all, is that having high-energy muons is our energy, and we can produce new particles with very high mass. So we convert energy of the colliding particles into mass of the new particles and see things that are otherwise too heavy to see in our regular lives. So let me go into this example for the Higgs a bit more because it's so important. The Higgs boson, the guard particle, as some people might call it. It's how we think mass is given to all the particles in the standard model. And thus far, everything is very consistent with our expectations. So the number that we like to measure is called the Higgs potential. And the Higgs potential is basically what tells us where the mass of these particles should be. And we think that the function that represents the Higgs potential should look something like this. But with our current measurements, it could look like any of these things. And I don't know about you, but if I'm pouring wine in a bottle, I want it to look like this and not like this. So the point is that we really want to be able to understand exactly what the shape is, because maybe it looks similar here, but if you go all the way out here in this function, it's very, very different, right? So only high energy at these machines can tell us the difference between all of these pictures. And that's what we want to achieve with these future colliders. So to give you a sense, with the current run at the LHC, these are the error bars. This black line is what we want, and this red line is anything that's possible. Okay, as we take more data with this next machine at CERN, these error bars shrink a little bit, and we know a little bit more certainly which potential it has to be. But then finally, at something high energy like the muon collider, now we can really constrain and see if this is consistent and really the thing that's giving our particles mass. So this is an amazing machine. Everyone should be excited. Why aren't we just building it? Well, we don't know how. So that's kind of a problem for experimentalists, not for me. And the reason that it's hard is because muons decay, like I said before, and they decay within 2 microseconds, which is rather short for human life scales, right? And it's hard at every step of the accelerating process because particles decay. So if you have protons, protons live forever, who cares? But with muons, you have to make them and use them immediately. So making enough muons to accelerate is hard. All right, so let's say you've made them. Now, you can't just have a cloud of muons. You have to have a tiny little bullet of muons. And so getting them into the muon shape of the bunch, we call that cooling. That's hard, and you lose a lot of muons there too. All right, now you have your bullet of muons. What are you going to do with it? You need to throw it around an accelerator. That's 10 kilometers. How many particles do you lose over 10 kilometers? That's hard too. And finally, you go to collide them, but even as you're colliding them, they're decaying. So every step of this is so much harder because particles decay. But just because it's hard doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Okay, so what do we do now? Now is really the time to plan for the future. We know sort of the next steps of the LHC. We're very excited to get this data set and analyze it, but we also need to plan for these long scale experiments. We should be investing in this new technology to be able to build a possible muon collider, and we should be using our time at the LHC to learn more about particle physics and analysis tools and detectors so we can go forward. But ultimately, I really suggest that we should be innovating to make this very mature scientific field survive. Because if we don't keep thinking about the next steps that's truly fundamentally new from what we've done before, is this really important field might completely disappear. So I leave you with the idea that we should, let's collide muons.
Thank you very much. And now we have time for questions. Uprashanya. If there's no questions, well, there is one question.
Okay, thank you for this nice review. I would ask you a question like a theorist. So you're talking about some machines, but still a standard model looks unsatisfying because we don't have gravity there. And also going to higher intensities, the coupling strength does not take the same point in standard model. So my question for you is, we have some GUTs, we have string theories and etc. Which model, from your point of view, will be a good opening to start the standard model?
So you're asking me, what do I think the most likely theoretical resolution is to our current mess of particle physics? Well, so far, nothing we have done is inconsistent with our theory of gravity, except for the number of dimensions we think we live in and the lack of supersymmetry. So that's a bit difficult. Okay, there's what we call an effective field theory that's consistent. So I think I can't give you a nice concrete answer. I would love it if supersymmetry was real because it's just so nice, so elegant. But of course, you know, mainly just eye candy for theorists. But I do think that the secrets that we have in the physics are pertaining to the Higgs boson, because truly the biggest mystery that connects to all these other questions you ask is why the Higgs boson has such a small mass. Because of this idea of gravity, same mechanisms suggest that it should be at a much higher energy scale than it is. So I think that the Higgs is hiding some secrets. If I had the answer for you, I would also have a Nobel Prize. So my solution is just we got to build the high energy, go take a peek, and then maybe I'll come back to you with some better ideas.
Okay, any other question?
Hello. Has there been any timetable done for Muon Collider? Like when it should be started to be built or something?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I have a much less responsibility than Arno, and I get to answer this. So we have what's called a technically limited timescale, which is if we were to get a check from any government tomorrow and start working on it, we have an idea when it can start. So roughly what we think we need is we need 7 years of research and development to actually prove that we know how to build this to scale. And then on top of that, we need at least another 10 years to construct it. So ideally, if we had all of the money tomorrow and nothing went wrong unexpectedly, which is impossible, we could have it running in roughly 2045. A much more realistic projection is something like 2055. And then if we have the FCCEE, that timeline's probably pushed again. So I'd love to say 20 years, probably more like 30 at best.
And what are the expectations? Any other over those that you already mentioned?
What are the expectations of, pardon?
Of the Muon Collider.
Yeah. So
what did you provide? What information? Yes.
Yeah, great question. Do you work for a government funding agency? You're asking all the questions they ask us to. So the things that we need to provide is we need to do these Higgs precision measurements, right? Is we need to do all the things that make it completely, ensure that it's completely consistent what we think our theory of the Higgs and mass is and what we actually see. Is we need to push that down to even further decimal. So right now we know the shape, like you see, to at best an order of magnitude. That needs to be concrete. And so that's something we can do like I showed you. The couplings of the Higgs to other particles is also something we definitely need to measure. And then something nice that we can do at muon colliders is we can even measure basically what happens when these heavy gauge bosons, the Zs and Ws, start to look light like photons. So there's all these phenomena that start when we have really heavy particles, they start to look comparatively light when we're at these high energies. So basically, to give you the short answer, is making sure we still agree with standard model predictions even at 10 TeV energies. So a factor of 10 above what we see at the LHC, that is definitively going to be done. I wish I could promise you a new particle too, but that's a bit less likely to happen.
You mentioned the number of Higgs bosons you could produce with this accelerator. I believe it was 10,000.
A million.
Yeah, per year.
That's
10 million integrated over the time that we would run. So likely over 5 to 10 years, we would produce that 10 million.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, najlepsza chwała za zaproszenie. Thank you for the questions and thank you for the talk. Zdaj smo se malo pogovarjali o planih pa o sanjah. Po 2 do 3 minutnem odmoru se bomo pa vrnili na delce, ki v resnici sploh ne vemo, jih zelo težko zaznamo, tako da včasih so tudi ti delci mečke zasanjavi. Tako da 2 do 3 minute, 2 to 3 minutes and we're back. Ok, torej spoznali smo že 2 različna predloga za pospeševalnike delcev v prihodnosti. Spoznali smo že tudi neke nove delce, torej govorili smo o mioni, govorili smo o Higgsu, ampak to še ni vse, kar lahko si ogledamo v prihodnosti, to še ni vse, kar nas čaka v prihodnosti. Tako da naša zadnja govorka bo govorila o projektu, ki je v resnici že najbližje realnosti, ker se dejansko stvari že dogajajo. Govorila pa bo o zelo posebnih delcih, govorila bo o nevtrinih. Nevtrini pa, no, ne bom raje jaz od njih razlagala, bolj, da se potem naš naslednja govorka s tem mečkam več posveti. Torej, doktorica Kate Shaw je izredna profesorica fizike delcev na Univerzi Sussex in Mednarodnem centru za teoretično fiziko. Sodeluje pri eksperimentu Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, torej DUNE, v Fermilabu in pri eksperimentu Atlas v CERNu, ki raziskuje temeljno naravo snovi z namenom boljšega razumevanja delovanja vesolja. Aktivna je tudi na področjih odprtih podatkov, znanstvene komunikacije in globalnega znanstvenega posredovanja znanosti. So, Kate, I see in your bio that you're doing stuff with open data. Aren't you like worried about open data? Like if you put all of your stuff on the internet so it's accessible to everyone, aren't you afraid that people are going to steal your stuff?
Thanks for the question, Anja. So just to say, I work on the Atlas experiment, the Large Hadron Collider, and this DUNE experiment, neutrino physics. And in particle physics, we do make our data available for everybody to access, to analyze. You can go online and find it for Atlas and CMS and other experiments. And no, we're not worried they're going to steal our data. We really want people to have a look and have a play, because what we're doing at CERN and in DUNE and in these big experiments is really exciting. And we really want everybody to get stuck in and have a go. So please do check it out online.
So you're not worried that someone's going to steal the idea of DUNE, build it faster than you, and then get to the solutions before you?
If they'd loved it, we would love if that happened. We'd love them to join the collaboration, yes.
Well, okay, then just tell us a bit more about DUNE and the floor is yours.
Thank you. So thanks so much for having me. Yeah, my name's Kate Shaw. I'm from Sussex. I work on the Large Hadron Collider on the Atlas experiment for about 20 years. And I'm also joining this neutrino experiment the last 5 years or so. So this experiment is brand new and it's really like a next generation type of particle detector. So have you heard of neutrinos before? Does anyone know where the word neutrino comes from? Which language? Neutrino. Yes? Italian, exactly. You notice the eno at the end. Okay, like cappuccino. So it's an eno. So neutralino. Sorry, I always end up saying this. Neutrino is because it's a neutral but little neutral particle. We've heard of the neutron. A neutrino is a tiny neutral particle. And it's fascinating. So we heard from Arno before about particle physics and all the fascinating particles, the top quark, the Higgs boson. But the neutrino is one of the most exciting particles in the Standard Model because it's the one that does not behave. It has funny properties. It oscillates. It has different flavors. And so we need dedicated experiments to study just the neutrino, and we'll have a look at why. Can we move forward? Here we go. So our experiment is based in United States. Oops. And this is Chicago, where there's Fermilab. So Fermilab is a bit like CERN, but it's based in the US, and it's going to be sending a beam of neutrinos about 1,300 kilometers underneath the Earth's crust. So that's 1,300 kilometers to another laboratory. So this is SURF, Sanford Lab. It's in South Dakota. Do you know where South Dakota is? Have you heard of Deadwood? Have you seen the series Deadwood, anyone? It's where they went to find gold. And so at this place in South Dakota, there was a lot of gold. So they built deep mines about a mile underground. And now all the gold's gone. What do they do with this mine? Well, it's perfect for neutrino experiments, also dark matter experiments. But I'm going to talk about neutrino experiments. So these neutrinos can come underground, and a mile underground, we build in these huge caverns detectors that can detect neutrinos. Why do we do it underground? Does anyone know? Why don't we do it on the Earth's surface? Does anyone know? Yes? What do you think? Just have a guess. Yes, you're absolutely right. It's protect them from the cosmic ray. If we put them here, it would be absolutely busy. Our detector would be detecting everything. Okay, and that's great. But we want to look at neutrinos. And as we find out, neutrinos hardly ever interact. So if we put it up here, we wouldn't be able to see it. But when we put it a mile underground, which does not matter at all to a neutrino, the Earth absorbs all the particles. My clicker's not working well. So, what are neutrinos? So neutrinos are as near to nothing as you can imagine. They are absolutely as near to nothing as you can imagine. They have almost zero mass. Okay, almost zero mass. They're also the most abundant particle in the universe. So there's more neutrinos than any other particle. How many neutrinos do you think goes through my finger every second? About 60 billion. 60 billion neutrinos are going through your finger every second. How many through your body? Can you do the maths? About 500 trillion neutrinos are going through our body every second right now. So we're literally in a sea of neutrinos, okay? Luckily, they don't interact very often, and so they're completely harmless. The Earth and everything around us has always been around a sea of neutrinos. They go straight through us, straight through the Earth, and they continue their galactic journey across the universe. And most of them will never interact with anything, so they're not very friendly. So they have almost no mass. They have almost no they have exactly no electric charge. At least when you have an electric charge, like an electron has negative charge, a proton has positive charge, it means it interacts with things electromagnetically, okay? So it really has no electric charge, almost no mass, and it travels through solid rock. You can have miles of steel. In fact, I worked out the other day how much distance of steel would you need to interact or stop a neutrino beam completely? How much do you think? A meter, would that stop a neutrino beam? So if you had to say, let's think about it with light. If I have an inch of light, would that stop a photon? Through some glass, say? The photon would go straight through the glass. But if it was lead, it would absorb all of it. But you need about a light year of lead to absorb most of a neutrino beam. So they're a bit annoying because they don't interact. And we think they may hold the key to why anything exists here at all. Yeah, so 60 billion neutrinos pass through every centimeter square every second. Where do they come from? My clicker's not working. There we go. So most of them come from the sun. So we all know nuclear fusion. You turn hydrogen into helium. And what do we make? Mostly we make photons, right? Which is light, okay? And most of that will get absorbed by everything on the Earth. Photons don't pass through matter, right? So you feel it as heat, okay? Not just light. Also, neutrinos and positrons are created. So neutrinos are emitted just as much as photons from the sun, but the Earth is basically invisible. Okay, they go straight through the Earth. So at nighttime, when you're asleep, neutrinos are coming straight through your bed and straight through you and again out to space. Okay, so the sun will get absorbed onto the Earth, but the neutrinos go straight through. So I'm gonna ask you a mean question now. After being produced in the sun, so you've made a photon and you've made a neutrino, how long do they take to get to Earth? So how long do you think the photon takes to reach Earth? And how long for the neutrino? 8 minutes. So the neutrino from being produced does indeed take 8 minutes because it goes at the speed of light. The photon actually takes tens to hundreds of thousands of years. Yeah, that's why it was a mean question. You're absolutely right. When it comes out from the sun, it takes eight minutes to travel. But photons, when they're created, because they interact with matter, they bounce around for literally 10 to hundreds of thousands of years before they manage to exit. Neutrinos don't have that problem. So by studying neutrinos from the sun, we can learn a lot about the sun. And that also means for supernovae, exploding stars, we can learn exactly what happens. Because the neutrino comes out immediately, whereas photons bounce around a lot. Ah, yes. Well, let me go right back one slide. So when they put, when they first put neutrino detectors down this gold mine in South Dakota to measure the number of neutrinos coming from the sun, and they could do the mathematics, so we knew how many neutrinos should be coming, we knew the mass of the sun, how big it is, we knew how many neutrinos should be detected. And when they detected them, they only found 1/3 of the number we expected. So can you think why that is? So at first, the experimentalist like me said to the theorist, you must have done your calculation wrong. You must have. We are good physicists. We have definitely measured this much, and it's one third of what you've detected. And the theorist said to the experimentalist, no, no, we've done our calculations correctly. Okay, you must be measuring it wrong. It definitely should be this number, and you haven't done your calculations correct. It's wrong. So do you know why we only detected one third? Okay, now on the next slide. So the neutrinos come in three flavors. Okay, you can imagine them like ice cream, vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry. Okay, but we call these, if anyone remembers before how we talked about the leptons, they are all connected to a lepton. So a neutrino, we draw in the Greek letter nu, which is N, but it looks a bit like a V. And this is an electron neutrino. This is a muon neutrino, the Greek letter for M, and a tau neutrino, the Greek letter for tau. And the sun, and most things actually, emit electron neutrinos. But what is fantastic is when they travel from the sun towards us, they do a thing called oscillate. And we don't understand why or how that happens, but they change into each of these different flavors. So by the time they got to the Earth, only a third were electron neutrinos, a third muon neutrinos, and a third tau neutrinos. And this is something we don't understand in particle physics. And one of the big questions we're trying to understand, why and how do neutrinos, it's like me throwing you an orange and you catch a banana. It doesn't make sense in our particle physics world. We don't understand why. Next slide. So just to say, where else do they come from? So we mentioned they come from the sun. They also come from us. This is a picture of me. No, it's a picture of a human being. Let's start with bananas. So do you know that bananas emit neutrinos? You know how many neutrinos a banana emits every second? About 13. It's absolutely true. 13 neutrinos every second. Do you know why? Why do you eat bananas? What mineral have they got that's good for you? Potassium. So potassium is a type of particle, element, get there in the end, that decays and emits neutrinos. So this is about 13 neutrinos a second. Also avocados, potatoes, spinach, anything with potassium. What about human beings? Why do we emit neutrinos? Also potassium. It's just because of potassium, this one thing that we eat. And we emit 4,000 neutrinos every second. Okay, 4,000 every second is quite a lot, isn't it? They also come from nuclear reactors, supernovae, cosmic rays. But the majority that we emit, that come through our bodies are always going to be from our sun. Next slide, please. Okay, so why are they interesting? So neutrinos may answer a big question that Arno touched on before about matter and antimatter. We think it might explain why any of this is here at all. Okay, so let me tell you the story. Okay, if we rewind cosmic history and we look back to the beginning of the universe, matter and antimatter, okay, should have been created in equal amounts. Next slide. Okay, so the universe likes to be neutral. It can't just make one thing and not the other. The universe likes to balance. If it makes positive particles, it has to make negative particles. We can all imagine that, right? The universe likes to be neutral. Okay, if they come together, if they meet, what happens? A particle and antiparticle come together. So what happens? They annihilate, which like they cancel out and turn into a photon. Okay, so if I met an antimatter Kate from an antimatter universe, we shook hands, we would be no more. Okay, so what does this mean about the universe? It means that the beginning of the universe, artist impression, there should have been an equal amounts of matter and antimatter, which would have met and everything would annihilate, but then nothing would be here. No planets, no stars, no you and me, no planets. There shouldn't be anything. But there is a lot of matter. So where has this imbalance come from? How is this possible? We are here. We do have the planets. We do have the stars. We never touch something and accidentally annihilate part of our hand. There's hardly any antimatter. The sun actually makes antimatter, positrons, quite a lot. You get some in cosmic rays, but it's less than, it's a very, very, very small number. So we think at the beginning of the universe, there might have been a tiny imbalance. Okay, so we made a billion antimatter particles, but then we made a billion and one matter particle. Just that tiny difference, and all the billion and matter and antimatter annihilated and did turn into light, and we can see that light. We know that that happened, but that tiny imbalance has made up everything. So every single particle in your body and in stars and planets is a rare probability of us being that extra billion and one particle. And we think neutrinos hold the answer for why that imbalance happened. Next slide. So for Dune, our deep underground neutrino experiment, we want to look at the difference between a neutrino beam and an antineutrino beam and see if we can see there's an imbalance. Do you see what we're trying to do? Okay, it's something that is a very, very difficult to observe because we need a, what's called a long baseline. That means we need to send it a long way. 1,300 kilometers has never been done before. When we send the neutrinos, they will oscillate. We'll measure how they oscillate, and we'll see if there's a difference in that oscillation between the particles and the antiparticles, and see if we can understand the universe. We're also going to be sensitive to supernovae. Okay, when there's a supernova, you know, an exploding massive star in the universe, neutrinos, as we learned at the beginning, they will come here first before light. They normally, the neutrinos from a supernova will get to Earth about 7 minutes before light. So if there's a supernova in the night sky, the neutrino experiments will discover that first, okay? Because the light's bouncing about trying to get out. In that 7 minutes, Dune can tell all the telescopes around the world to point their telescopes in the right direction to get that supernovae. And you can learn a lot about exploding stars from the supernovae, from neutrinos and photons. And the last thing we're going to be looking at is just new physics, absolutely the same as Large Hadron Collider physics. This is really what we all want to be sensitive to, okay? You build these big detectors, we don't always know what's going to happen. We often have surprises. Okay, it's a very sensitive detector, and we're going to be sensitive to any new type of particle collision or anything new out of the ordinary. We're going to be able to detect. So this is a picture, the schematic of how it's going to work. This is Fermilab, where they emit the proton beams, the neutrino beams, and they travel 1,300 kilometers to the detectors 1 mile underground, okay? And they will oscillate. So you can see here it starts at Fermilab as a muon neutrinos. This is what we emit. And as they travel, this is our theory, more and more will turn into tau neutrinos and oscillate into electron neutrinos. And we'll do a bunch of measurements. We want to know, we want to learn many things about the oscillation. We also want to measure their masses and understand how neutrinos have this extremely small mass. So this is our timeline. This is showing on what's going on at the world at the moment. We're an international collaboration, 1,500 collaborators from, you know, we're from Chile to Madagascar, Norway, to Japan. We have collaborators in about 222 different institutions, 38 countries. And you can see around the world, lots of different detectors are being built. And we're here now in 2026, when we're beginning the first Dune detectors going to go underground, and we're going to start making data in 2029. A really exciting time for neutrino physics. So thanks for listening.
Thank you so much for this. And now it's time for some questions. Okay, we have a question over there.
Actually, I do have two questions, one technical and another is more fundamental. The technical question is about geometry of experiment. Why do you have some deflection? Why is the line is not straight from Fermilab to Stanford? So what is the reason? And the fundamental question is, what do you think, the neutrino is a Dirac particle or Majorana particle?
That is very technical. So
I mean, this is a schematic, okay? There's no bump in the earth here. The earth is curved. So if you want to go to South Dakota from Chicago, you have to point your beam downwards. So that is, it is going in a straight line. It's just going down. So you have to, this is a little bump, but it's very, very small. You have to get your beam onto the target that makes it go through the earth's crust. So it's going down and it pops out South Dakota. And then we don't know what the nature of neutrinos will be. That's, you know, the nature of neutrinos is really exciting. Big questions there, but I don't want to go straight into Dirac and Majorana quite yet.
Do we have one more?
There is a project called Legend taking place in Max Planck Institute in Germany. I guess you know about it. They are trying to find out about double beta decay in germanium, which would show, as far as I understand, if neutrino is Majorana particle or not. Are these your Dune experiment and Legend somehow connected, or do they share some information?
Good question. So we have, there's many neutrino experiments, but they're all sensitive to slightly different questions. We're mostly sensitive to neutrino oscillations, matter-antimatter asymmetry, and supernovae. We can still measure other things, but we're not the most sensitive. I don't know specifically that experiment, but I know, for example, Snow Plus in Canada, they're very sensitive to double beta decay, and they will hopefully also answer that question, which is really interesting. It's to do with most particles are left and right-handed, which means they can spin both ways. Neutrinos, for some reason, only spin one way, and that's really interesting. Again, we don't really understand why. And trying to answer that is this question.
Okay, mamo shikaku vrashanie. Any more questions? If not, we have to conclude this evening anyway because we are running out of time. Thank you again, Kate. Jaz grem pa zdaj nazaj na slovenščino. Najlepša hvala vsem, da ste prišli sem. Še posebej velika zahvala Znanosti na cesti, da nas je tega gostila. Zahvala tudi Univerzi v Ljubljani in društvu IPOG, ki so seveda sofinancirali ta dogodek. Zdaj pa še posebej zahvala tudi Centru ROK in kavarni Specialka, da so nas tukaj gostili. Skeptiki se zdaj odpravljajo na poletne počitnice. Vračamo se nazaj septembra, tako da vsem skupaj želimo en lep dopust ali pa eno lepo preživeto poletje. Najlepša hvala in se vidimo.
Spremljajte Znanost na cesti na znc.si. Redno se oglašajo na svojem Facebook in Twitter profilu. Na podcast se lahko naročite na svojem mobilnem telefonu.
Znanost na cesti, znanje in ideje na prepihu.